Hello and welcome to another episode of Fiction Hack. We are the podcast where we are unlocking a deeper experience of the modern story. My name is Colin Munro. As ever, I am joined by
Ross Larhead. Hello.
Hello, Ross. How are you doing?
Doing okay.
What is it that we're talking about this week?
Well, so we've done a comic episode quite recently, but we're going to go back to that well again.
So hang on, you mean comic as in comic book?
Yes, right. Comic book instead of a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
Which is what I call them to avoid confusion. But so we did do a comic book oriented episode quite recently with the Ant-Man and the Wasp movie that came out, giving a little bit of a primer for those who wanted to have a more of an understanding about the characters and who they are and why they are.
Mm-hmm.
But just in the last 2 weeks, there is news that one of the creators of what is still considered to be modern comic books died, unfortunately. And that was Steve Ditko, who had a hand in creating some real iconic characters, Spider-Man, one of them.
I've heard of him.
Doctor Strange was another, mm-hmm. and then we'll get to some of the others later on. But you know, obviously the Spider-Man movies are a big deal these days. Doctor Strange was a fairly kind of solid hit for Marvel. Some people didn't get blown away by it, but it was still a very different kind of character than we see with a lot of the superheroes. So yeah, I thought we'd just talk about him, just talk about his
contribution. Yeah.
Contribution, not just to comic books, but to kind of, modern day culture. Mm-hmm. Because, think about Spider-Man, just kind of how big a deal he is. And there have been six Hollywood blockbuster movies that have, just been Spider-Man by himself. He was a really interesting guy. A lot of kind of different facets to his personality, which again, we can talk about.
Yeah.
So should we start? Let's just start kind of with him and Marvel, because he was one of the people with Stan Lee and Jack Kirby who were in at the ground floor. Marvel used to be called Timely Comics. We touched on this a little bit with the Ant-Man series, is that before Marvel was Marvel and they were doing superheroes, they did a lot of kind of monster comics and comics with a twist at the end, an O. Henry twist of, the thing you think is the thing isn't the thing, it's something else. And
What is an O. Henry twist?
So O. Henry was an author of short stories who would write, they're not even really mysteries, but they're just these little tales where there's a twist at the end. So that was what was selling in comics at the time, is you would just have these kind of 5 to 10 page short comic stories that would incorporate that kind of a twist into mm-hmm. them. And Steve Ditko was doing these with Stan Lee. The comics industry was flagging because people were kind of tired of the monsters thing. People were tired of these little twist stories. And the publisher of Timely Comics, Archie Goodwin, said to Stan Lee, well, look, why don't you just, do a superhero thing? That's what DC is doing with Superman and Justice League. He said, why don't you write a superhero team book? And so Stan Lee, mm-hmm. Went away, thought about it, and he came back with the Fantastic Four. And then that was the first Marvel comic. And from then, they just launched right into the superheroes, because that was a huge success commercially.
Right. And so were they Marvel at that point? At that point,
they became Marvel. It was kind of mm-hmm. rebranding that took place with the superhero line. They decided they're going to be Marvel Comics instead of Timely Comics. Those are kind of broad strokes. There is more to it than that. But that's the best way to think about it.
Yeah.
If you look at what Marvel was doing at the beginning in the context of twists and monsters, then you can actually see a follow-through. The first four Fantastic Four comic books, they fought monsters or aliens of a certain type. Hmm. And looking at the first Spider-Man story, which actually appeared in Amazing Fantasy number 15, along with two other stories that were these kind of generic twist stories about aliens and Martians and whatnot. So the first Spider-Man you know, his origin is a twist tale in that, you know, he gets these powers and he becomes this WrestleMania character. And which, and while he's getting paid, then the offices are burgled by someone who he allows to escape.
And Spider-Man
allows this guy to escape.
This is in like the first Spider-Man story.
Yeah, and it's in the movies as well. So okay, it's in, I mean, it's in the Andrew Garfield one. It's in the Tobey Maguire one. Thankfully, we've been spared any sort of reprise of that lately, because everybody, you know, has been hammered into this. You know, the Spider-Man origin is that, you know, Spider-Man allows this burglar to go free, who eventually comes and kills his uncle, essentially. And then that's the twist, is that if he had just taken responsibility, then someone he loved would still be alive. And so that's the guilt that follows Spider-Man along, is that with great power comes great responsibility. And it's a main drive of the character, in that he never feels like he can do enough in any situation. He can't save enough people. His great powers are never enough to save the people that he loves from death, or, you know, save anybody from death.
Right.
The character was hugely popular, and so they gave him his own title. They canceled Amazing Fantasy and started with Amazing Spider-Man a few months after that, in order to get it up and running.
Okay.
But the artist was Steve Ditko, this guy who we're talking about today.
Okay, so I think actually some people who might be listening might be like me and not know much about comic books. So comic books have like a writer and an artist who sort of work separately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually several artists, since you can write quicker than you can draw, or most people can. Mm-hmm. And the way it's evolved is that even though comic books are a separate medium to anything else, the way they've been sold has been like magazines. So it's evolved just kind of for speed. So the way to the industry basically decided it was going to make its money is to release 22-page comic book story in a 32-page kind of magazine format, which would allow for 10 pages of advertisements. Yeah, so what you would need, usually, is one writer, one penciler, one mm-hmm. inker, one letterer, and a colorist. So that would be your kind of bare-bones team. And then on top of that, you've got editorial and all that. So with Marvel Comics starting out, they kind of developed a different way of working, which was all based around Stan Lee's way of writing, essentially. And people are kind of down on Stan Lee when they hear about this, but it's important to realize that he was always more than a writer anyway. Mm-hmm. And he contributed a lot to the industry just in terms of energy and vitality and promotion, which it really needed at that time. So it's not stretching it too far to say that he did kind of save the comic book industry.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what he would do was just kind of give an idea. He'd call up the illustrators, or they'd come into the office. They'd just kind of chat for a little bit, and he'd say, okay, well, you know, you do a story where the hero is, you know, walking down the street and he falls into a hole and suddenly he's on another planet. And we'll use this villain that we've come up with now called Mysterio, and he'll find out that it's an illusion. That would be what he'd give the artist to work on. Sometimes a little bit more, sometimes even a little bit less. And the artist would then go away, and they'd be responsible not just for, you know, drawing Spider-Man page 3, panel 2, you know, a face talking. They would have to come up with the pacing of the story, you know, just everything that happened. And often they'd throw in a few panels or a few pages even of just, you know, the hero talking to his friends, just so they'd have a little bit more opportunity for Stan Lee then to go back in and, or someone else to go back in and write just the word balloons, the dialogue, which would happen at the end of that stage. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about early Marvel Comics, it's important to realize that the artists had often as much sometimes more input in the story and the development of the characters than the credited writer did. And that doesn't just follow on from Stan Lee, that follows on from just about any writer at that time, because that got to be known as the inverted, you know, commas, the Marvel method of writing a story. Okay. And then as it went on in the 70s and 80s, it got a little bit more. So, you know, sometimes you'd get a one-page synopsis, you know, from the author, and then, you know, the artist would kind of do the story, and then, you know, the writer would go in and do all the words after that. And it kind of, I don't know, not to get too much into it, but it was not a, it's not a great way to work. And that's where people rarely work that way nowadays.
Because nowadays, usually, isn't there like a whole format for writing a script for a comic book, which, you know,
these
the,
days it's usually,
the writer does a bit more than that, and then...
Yes. These days it looks pretty much like a film script, a comic book script. It's often formatted in the same way. It's all just kind of, you know, how the artist likes to work. It's kind of gone back and forth a little bit. There are some writers like Alan Moore who write really exhaustive screenplays and scripts for the comics. And if you've seen the script for some of the Watchmen comics, he'll go maybe 4 or 5 pages just describing what happens in one page, because there is so much that's so complex in
picture
his
paints
story,
1,000 words.
Well, exactly, yeah. In his case, it's kind of a literal truth. And, you know, that's just the way that he works. That's, you know, how you create something like Watchmen. You know, he needed to have that. Most writers now will just have kind of dialogue and kind of what happens in a scene, a little bit of a setup. And they won't even say panel by panel what happens. They'll leave that up to the artist using their own artistic sensibilities to pace the page. So, you know, it's always a bit of a balancing act, and it really depends on, you know, what kind of artist you've got, what kind of writer you are, as to how you operate these days. So there's a lot more flexibility. But it is very much
a collaborative effort between at least two people or maybe more.
Exactly. Because the penciler is the person who, you know, draws the figures and paces out the comic itself, he usually gets kind of the lion's share of the credit in terms of, well, just kind of, you know, fame and notoriety sometimes. Whereas, you know, doing the inking, which is going over the pencils, is just as skilled a craft. And there are pencilers who are bad inkers. There are inkers who are very good pencilers as well. So it is all by necessity. And these days it's more common to find an artist who has done, you know, the entire process themselves, especially with digital drawing. You can pretty much, you know, draw in ink, essentially, is what you do on a PC.
Yeah.
And then someone else usually comes in with the colors anyway. You very rarely find a penciler who do the colors. But yeah, we're kind of wandering off the topic.
So you talked a lot about Stan Lee, presumably because Steve Ditko worked as Stan Lee's penciler. Is that right?
Well, yeah, this is what I'm saying. So this is important stuff to know, that when you're talking about early Marvel and you're talking about who created these characters, it's important to realize that the artists had just as much, maybe more of an input into the characters than Stan Lee did. And that's not just in terms of design or the look of the character, but also in who that character became, because they would have been, at the very least, co-writers in those early adventures with Stan Lee. And so so Jack Kirby was one of the biggest names in comics, and still is, with just the reputation that he's gained. And he co-created Fantastic Four, the X-Men, the Avengers, most of the individual characters of the Avengers, I believe Thor, Incredible Hulk. He was just kind of, not only was he illustrating and co-writing these books, but he was also kind of the go-to guy for how a character would look, a kind of art director in some cases. Mm-hmm. Because he had been there at the beginning, they wanted to keep drawing comics the way that he would been drawing them,
just for
in order
sort of
to keep their sales. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Because that's what sold, and that's what worked, and that's what, you know, they're making their reputation on.
So he was very much instrumental in defining that early Marvel look.
Yes.
And brand, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
And his style continued to develop to become very particular to him, and you can, you know, spot a Jack Kirby comic almost from a mile away because he's got such a distinct style.
How can you do that then? Tell me, what is that style? What is it that says Jack Kirby? What is his name?
Yeah, I mean, the word iconic kind of gets bandied around a lot, but there is a way of kind of portraying, you know, certain objects or people, you know, something as complex as a hand. It's hard to describe. I think, you know, you could look at it in terms of even film and say that, you know, there would be a lot of kind of... If you were to recreate in film, you would have to do a lot with lenses because there's a lot that looks like it's kind of coming out at you and a lot of foreshortening, very dynamic poses. Often he's very good at using composition as well, which is not something that's taught a lot in art, but is very important in comic art, just how something is arranged on a page in order to give certain panels more impact than other panels. Not that there's any less important panels, but sometimes you do need to have a more striking image for some of them. And so you'll, you know, pull back in some areas just so that you can deliver a harder hit in other areas. And so if you look at a Fantastic Four, an early Fantastic Four comic book, it by today's standards, it doesn't look like it's very well drawn. And even Steve Ditko's stuff looks even less well drawn. But the kind of the penmanship and the rendering ability isn't the only thing that's happening on that page. There is a flow and, like I say, composition that is very hard to teach. It's easier to intuit, which these people had. And even, you know, pulling away from that and saying, well, you know, there's design elements here as well, which, you know, just in the way the character looks and the way that, you know, the colors are laid out, you know, why Doctor Strange has yellow gloves instead of blue gloves, you know, is kind of a big deal, just in terms of how the story actually reads. And a lot of these elements, you'd be surprised about how, you know, how many people who, you know, are kind of famous today just don't have a grasp on those elements. So it is kind of hard to read some artists' work, you know, if they're not laying it out correctly. So there's something more than just, you know, well, that face doesn't really, you know, look very good, does it? There's more going on to it than just that. And that's what these early guys had a handle on. Plus, they were creating these characters who have now become a part of just the national consciousness. And, you know, we can go back to Spider-Man. And so Steve Ditko was always kind of the quiet guy in the background, whereas Stan Lee was the flashy showman who would write these kind of letter pages, and he was always kind of like he is now. You know, he's in the movies, he's giving, you know, he's, you know, giving a nod and a wink, you know, hey, I'm the creator, and isn't this kind of fun? And, you know, he was always breaking the fourth wall in his writing. He was always addressing
what
the reader themselves.
Wall?
So, okay, the fourth wall. I know you know what the fourth wall is.
I've heard that expression, but off the top of my head, I can't remember what that is.
Yeah, that goes back to theater. Okay, so on a stage, you've got three walls, essentially, right? You've got the backdrop, and then you've got the wings. But in the audience's mind, those are kind of sides of the room, you know, or the stage. It comes from a time where usually you had kind of a play that was taking part in one place. Then the fourth wall is
where
the audience is looking through. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's an invisible wall. And the thing in theater is that you don't break that fourth wall. You don't turn to the audience and give a little wink and a nod or a chuckle or something like that. That's quite unprofessional. You know, you can, as a writer like Shakespeare did, you know, have a soliloquy, something that is played to the audience, but the character never knows that the audience is there. That's kind of the classical understanding. And then, of course, in modern theater, you have actors who would break the fourth wall. You know,
unless they're a sort of narrator... or something, in which case their scenes are kind of separate from the actual story itself.
Yeah, I mean, you would have to take them out of the Yeah, you're right. You know, the story and what's happening on stage to directly talk to the audience. But that would be breaking the fourth wall. So, I mean, it would happen, but, you know, under those
So you're saying Stanley, I mean, Stanley, I can see how he does that in his cameos a little bit nowadays, but you're saying he did that in the comic books as well?
Pick up some of the old comic books that Stanley has written, and, you know, he'll... the characters would be in the story, but then he would have little kind of narration boxes where he would talk about the story to the reader. He'd say things like, you know, don't worry, reader, you know, the thing isn't down for the count just yet. Turn the page and find out what happens next. Which is actually, I mean, even now...
Even
in the context of what was going on, that's kind of inappropriate. And... I found some real clunkers because, you know, I mentioned my Fantastic Four podcast. So I've read all of the Stan Lee, Jack Kirby Fantastic Four comic books. And there are times you can see the conflict that that he has had with the artists when they did something that he didn't like, because he would throw them under a bus. Occasionally he has drawn attention to badly drawn pictures. And there are even a few circumstances where Stan Lee hasn't understood what the artist has drawn, and he's actually gone a completely different way with, not completely different way, but he's gone a different way with the story. There's one, I remember one where Reed Richards is, you know, fighting somebody, Dr. Doom or Blastar or somebody like that, and he gets knocked out, and he's gone for a couple pages, and then he wakes up later on. That's how the story happens if you don't read the balloons and the captions. If you do read that, then he's actually speaking during that time off panel. And it's just hilarious because clearly he's lying there with his eyes closed, but he's got a speech balloon coming out. So Stanley just decided that it was better to have him still talking and not being knocked out than to try to, I don't know, to just go along with what was written. And either he didn't know or he wanted to kind of force himself more into the issue, and you do get that kind of tension a little bit where he, you know, you get the sense that he would come in and try to justify his presence as a writer. That's kind of being a little bit harsh, but
so his team must have hated him sometimes.
I think it was it's a personality thing. Looking at some of, you know, what people have said at the time and reading some biographies and stuff, I mean, he's just been this kind of flamboyant, bombastic personality. And, you know, after the 60s, he was kind of out of the office mostly anyway. He would take a kind of editor-in-chief role. And although there were still issues that he was quote-unquote writing, it would have been just in a terms of, well, you know, a line here, you know, half a page of, you know, a plot summary here, and then go away and write your story. But, you know, he would be doing stuff. He would be, you know, visiting college campuses. He'd be doing radio interviews. He'd be, you know, making appearances here and there, you know, trying to get, you know, going to Hollywood, trying to get... people doing, you know, TV shows, movies, whatever, trying to expand the brand and all that, which is great, which is what needed to happen. But yeah, this did lead to a lot of conflict with some of the artists he worked with. And, you know, Jack Kirby did leave Marvel Comics kind of under a pall just because of how he had been treated as an artist, and he just kind of had enough at one point. And going back to Steve Ditko, he was a guy who left very early on under circumstances which are still being debated. I think everyone's got a theory about, well, everyone subscribes to a different theory about why he left, which kind of leads to, you know, who Steve Ditko was as a person. And as I said at the beginning, he was someone who was very much in the background. He was very happy to draw all these stories, to be the artist, but he didn't want the limelight. He was very kind of prickly towards his fans. He would get awarded with awards and refuse them, saying that, you know, awards are terrible for the artists. They put us in competition with each other when we should be supporting each other. And so I'm not going to have any part of this. He said that with one of the later awards that he won. And he was very much a principled person. He also started getting into this philosophy at the time, philosophy is being generous, but it's called Objectivism, which is the author Ayn Rand. She wrote the book called Atlas Shrugged and also The Fountainhead, and it's very much alive today in the American Republican Party, where it's all about kind of keeping ownership over your creation. And it works better when you're in a field like comic books, where you do have intellectual property. Works a little bit less in something like the industrial field, where you think, well, you know, what does anybody actually own anyway? If you're digging up metal from a mountain or drilling oil from the ground, you know, you just found that, and that's not yours, really. Mm. But her hero was Henry Ford, who was, you know, the kind of self-made man, the industrialist, the creator, the inventor, the person who can not only create a car, but create the system to manufacture it on a large scale and then, you know, sell it to people en masse and just make lots of money in the bargain. It was always about money with Objectivism, and about capital and creating capital and intellectual capital. And it was very much against any sort of larger, you know, big society kind of stuff. It was very much against socialism. I think it was probably a reaction against socialism, being a post-war kind of philosophy, or one that grew into prominence post-war, where people, you know, like in Britain, you know, got together and make the NHS, you know, help everybody else out, you know. This was very much against that, because, you know, taxation just meant that you were sponging off of somebody else. So Henry Ford makes lots of money, so let's tax him, and we'll just, you know, feed people off of his ingenuity. It was always against that kind of thing. And As Ditko kind of went on in his career post-Marvel, and we'll talk about how he left Marvel, I'll circle back around to that, but he went more and more down this road and created some really quite shocking comics, which I've got and I've read, but they're kind of trying to explain these principles about kind of a determinism, kind of materialism, but, you know, kind of all brought together with capitalism into objectivism is kind of the meeting of those three philosophies. And so he was on that track. And this is why I kind of subscribe to the more traditional explanation of why he left Marvel Comics, was that basically he started to take more and more ownership over the Spider-Man storylines, more than Stan Lee did. And the editor, Stahl Brodsky, was kind of his go-between when, you know, you have Stan Lee as the showman, as the guy who was just kind of skating around. Yeah, hey, let's do an idea for this. Let's do an idea for this. Let's do an idea for this. And then you've got Steve Ditko, who is, and Jack Kirby, and he could look around and just see all these other artists who are sitting down slaving at their tables to create something out of nothing, you know, out of just ink and paper, to create something real. And then Stan Lee would come in and take a lot of credit for it. I think that kind of shaped a lot of his philosophy. And I think there would be obvious tension between those two people. You know, obviously not having been in the room, you don't have to be to see that those kind of two personalities are really on diametrically opposed sides of the spectrum. And I think traditionally what people have said is that Steve Ditko left because of differences in the character of the Green Goblin. And if you've seen the first Tobey Maguire movie, then you know who the Green Goblin is. Mm-hmm. And it's Norman Osborn, who is this businessman, industrialist, owns Oscorp, they tied it in that movie with the origin of Spider-Man himself, that he's doing studies on these spiders. Yeah. That wasn't in any of the early Spider-Man comics. In the early Spider-Man comics, the Green Goblin was actually a mystery about who he was. So they kept playing that out. It's like, you know, the Green Goblin would show up every once in a while, and then you would see him later on taking off his mask, but there'd be something in the way, or he'd be in shadows. And so the mystery identity of the Green Goblin was played out for quite a while. And eventually, it was revealed that it was going to be somebody who Spider-Man knew, who was one of the supporting characters. And again, this is kind of supposition, but it was decided that it was going to be Norman Osborn, this industrialist businessman who was just greedy, who was just out for the money, who was, you know, going to, you know, do whatever it took to satisfy his need for power.
Yeah.
And that is something which Steve Ditko would have been very much against, because a businessman who has all this power isn't someone who should be vilified. It's someone who should be praised and really kind of, you know, almost worshipped in a way. So people have said over the years that that's when the split happened. Now, both Steve Ditko and Stan Lee have gone on record as saying that that's not it. They were just kind of drifting apart anyway. And eventually Steve Ditko wanted to leave to do other things. And even at the time, you know, everybody was very cordial. As you know, Steve Ditko has decided to leave Spider-Man. So we wish him well in all his future endeavors. And, you know, now here's John Romita.
But the story, you know, sort of makes sense with that whole philosophy.
Yeah, it's hard to think that that wouldn't have been an element in it, you know, at the very least.
But
then you can look at kind of the things that he did after that. He went to a couple different publishers. He went across to DC, you know, the people who were making Superman and Batman and Green Lantern, and he did some kind of B-list characters who were very good characters. Hawk and Dove was a good one. The Creeper was a good one. The Creeper was kind of a Joker character who put on this kind of weird costume with a big kind of grin on it. He would just kind of bounce around and, you know, create as much mischief as he would kind of solve crimes. Hawk and Dove were the kind of avatar embodiments of war and peace. And there are two brothers, Don and Hank, who would turn into these two kind of archetypal characters and, you know, fight crime and all that in very different ways, which again, you know, had a nice bit of tension. He then went on to a company called, I've never found out if it was either Charlton Comics or Carlton Comics, and helped create a few superheroes in their line, notably Blue Beetle, he helped out on, The Question, who was a man in a trench coat who would put on a mask that would completely obscure his face, so it looked like he had no face. And he just had his hat, no face, and a trench coat on. And then Captain Atom, who was this military person who had the ability to change the properties of atoms and to create, you know, explosions and stuff out of his hands. Mm-hmm. And I'm only going into depth to describe these characters because these characters were later bought by DC in 1983, I think I read, and were given to a young British writer called Alan Moore, who decided he was going to make create the ultimate superhero story with these characters. And then at the last minute, the editors at DC said, no, you can't use these characters because we've got other plans for them. So he said, okay, fine, I won't use these characters. I'll make characters based on these characters, and then we'll use them. So The Question then became Rorschach, and Captain Atom became Dr. Manhattan. The Blue Beetle became Night Owl. And he created the Watchmen out of these characters that Steve Ditko had helped create. Uh-huh. And then that's where we got the movie. And, you know, the graphic novel is basically considered pretty much the best comic book that's ever been written, you know.
Which one? The Watchmen?
The Watchmen, yeah. It's won awards. It's constantly on, you know, top 100 books of all time. I think Time did a big kind of reader poll about 15 years ago, and that was the only comic book that was on it, was Watchmen. So again, you see sort of, you know, his influence in those early days really had kind of a knock-on effect to what's a big industry right now. And then he kind of drifted into obscurity after that because he still had this kind of prickly side to his character. From all accounts, he was very professional and very well liked by the people who he worked with. But then he went to one comic convention, pretty much the first comic convention, and basically told all the fans about how hard it was being an artist and how you don't get any money and no respect, and, you know, everybody walks all over you, and, you know, never be a part of this terrible, you know, industry. And everybody's kind of like, well, what a bummer. That's kind of a downer, man. And that was kind of, you know, the kind of last anybody ever really kind of heard or saw from him. So
when
you
was
were
that?
In, sorry?
When was that? convention?
This was in the 60s. Yeah, this was when Marvel was getting big. It was kind of like an explosion of popularity. It wasn't kind of a gradual growth. It was just kind of a storm. So yeah, fans instantly kind of set up shop and wanted to find out more about the artists, more about the writers. Mm. And then you had Stan Lee, who was encouraging this. He saw that this was a great opportunity to really kind of big up the name and, recreate this industry, which had been in a continual decline since the introduction of Superman in the 30s. And Steve Ditko was someone who just didn't want to play by that. He just wanted to be the artist. He wanted the art to speak for itself, and he didn't want to draw any attention to him as a person behind that. Which again, has this kind of noble aspect, but on the other hand, he was quite kind of rude in how he kind of portrayed that, and he was kind of a recluse until the end of his life. There was a Jonathan Ross, who's a British TV personality, yeah. Also a big comic book fan. Had a documentary in 2007. I didn't see this, but I remember it being
on. I saw it. Yeah.
Where he tried to track down this guy, who created Spider-Man and Doctor Strange and all these characters, and who was this, famous recluse. And they eventually did. I say they, because he went with Neil Gaiman, who again made his fame in the comic book field before going on to write just novels and now movies and episodes of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
They did find him and track him down in a New York apartment, and he did talk to them, but he refused to be interviewed, so he didn't say anything on the record. He refused to be filmed.
And, yeah, he invited them up for a chat, but didn't let the cameras up.
Yeah. So then you just had them talking about what he said to them afterwards, which again, it was very principled.
So what
guy.
Was he doing? So he wasn't. Doing
he was still
or?
Working to varying degrees. And again, as it went on, his art did develop, but it never really was up to scratch that people needed in the 80s or 90s or later. He would do these kind of little vanity projects, and I've got one here. It's called Avenging Worlds, which is kind of a collection of essays and little comics that he's done for small publishers. It's quite startling how angry it is, really. That's kind of the thing that really struck me. And he's got a couple of little essays in here where he really tries to claim ownership for the creation of Spider-Man himself, even in terms of powers and abilities and the character. He never got any royalties from Spider-Man or the movies or anything like that, because he did that as work for hire for Marvel.
Yeah.
That meant that Marvel owned the copyright. And
so he wasn't wealthy at all in any
no,
way.
No, really. He didn't, not in any real sense.
And he wasn't able to capitalize on his notoriety later
really,
on in
and,
any way? Or
yeah,
did he just
I mean,
choose
there,
not to?
This is the thing. There are varying accounts because we can't know. There are reports of him getting royalty checks, but he's also claimed that he didn't get one dime from Spider-Man at all. On the other hand, it's because he did so little, comparatively little work later on. He must have been living off of something, you'd think.
Yeah.
They don't even really know if he had any children. He's kind of existed just off the grid. All his life, and never even really had email, probably never had a computer, some people are saying. So when he died just recently, he was 90 years old. So it's someone like that can live off the grid if they've been used to it. But he continued to keep talking about objectivism, and I did do a blog about Steve Ditko and just kind of the track he went down, because I think it does tie into here's another knock-on effect. Zack Snyder is also a kind of basic objectivist. He was drawn to the Watchmen probably because of Steve Ditko's influence, and also he's now announced a he's going to do the Fountainhead, an adaptation of the Fountainhead, I think.
Right, and he's the guy who directed Man of Steel.
And if you look at Man of Steel and even, you know, bits of Justice League, you can see that, you know, Zack Snyder is very much, again, in conflict with the idea of what a hero is and what a villain is, even. Whereas, you know, the power that you've got for yourself should be for yourself and to enrich your own life. And anyone else who's trying to enrich their lives by using your gifts is a villain. You know, it is somebody who's just lazy, who wants entitlement, who just wants something for nothing. And so you get these weird scenes in Man of Steel where Superman just doesn't help people. And you've got his father and his mother saying, you know, be a hero or don't be a hero. You don't owe anybody anything. And, you know, Superman's father saying, yeah, just let people die, you know, just because, you know, if people find out what you can do, then they're going to want that for themselves. And so you've got a Superman who's not very super and he's not heroic in any sense. And so, you know, you just get this kind of guy who's flying around really angrily, blowing things up, which is, you know, it's kind of what you've got left if you kind of cut all that stuff out. Yeah. And, you know, looking at some of Ditko's later work, and he's got this character, Mr. A, and he's got these little comics about, you know, just kind of explaining, you know, how people get taken advantage of, who are the creators in this world. There is a lot of, it seems, unjustified anger. On the other hand, here's a man who helped build this huge industry who's just been completely cut out of it just because he signed a contract that was, I think by all accounts, very unfair, who should have more ownership over these characters. And he's not the only one who's been disenfranchised. There's even a comic book legal defense fund that's been set up just to look after the people who created these comics early on. Basically, everyone who isn't Stan Lee, you know, who isn't still kind of have their hands really, really tight into the industry. And again, that may seem kind of unfair on old Stan. And I'll reiterate what I said again at the beginning, is I don't think we would have the modern comic book industry unless it was for Stan Lee being who he was at that time. On the other hand, there was a lot of illustrators too.
Yeah.
They got a real kind of the bad end of the stick on a lot of this stuff. But going back to Steve Ditko, it is worth kind of looking at his stuff if you can find it. And as much as I love the early Spider-Man, also Doctor Strange is really something interesting to read, in the same way that the movie came along. And even though the character of Doctor Strange himself wasn't so great, you know, and even though it was Benedict Cumberbatch, and, you know, we'd seen the kind of Marvel superhero origin before, it really introduced this kind of weird design aesthetic and this kind of magical element into Marvel itself that was there with him. And it makes that early work as interesting as, you know, the movie adaptation has been.
So have you been reading anything interesting yourself this week?
It's the reading segment. I've not been doing so much reading, but I did watch a Netflix original series, which was kind of entertaining. It's called The Hollow, and it's an animated series of 10 episodes. It looks kind of like a kid's cartoon, but it has a kind of strong mystery element. Of kind of the kind of weird kind of American gothic kind of thing, which I like. So it's, you know, three children wake up in a room, a kind of bunker, not knowing their names or where they are or how they got there. And then they have to find out what's going on in this strange world where strange things are happening, and then try to escape. And it's kind of obvious, I guessed it quite early on, what was the real reality. But it was still quite entertaining as well. That's called The Hollow, and it's on Netflix.
You recommending that then?
Yeah, if you like that sort of thing. If you like cartoon series, which I do. Yeah, because I'm also watching Voltron Legendary Defender, which is Voltron done by most of the team from Avatar, Last Airbender, and Korra, Legends of Korra. So that's really well made. And it's, you know, it's funny when it needs to be funny. It's dramatic when it needs to be dramatic. The action sequences are pretty good. Not as good as Korra or Avatar, but it's still quite inventive. How about you? What are you up to?
Well, I did finally get around to starting Westworld, the TV show. I'm really enjoying that. I'm only three episodes in, so I don't really have too much to say. But
To the first season or the second season?
First season, yeah.
First season, okay.
So I don't have too much to say about that. But yeah, other than, yeah, I'm enjoying it. It's pretty good.
How are you getting on with The Tale of Two Cities? Have you abandoned that yet? Or are you still going?
I haven't abandoned it yet, but yeah. I haven't got much further with that.
Okay.
It's not gripped me, you know. It's failed to grip me. It's too wordy.
Too wordy. Well, there you go.
Yeah, so if you're wondering what we're talking about, you're going to have to listen back to, what was it, episode 4, where we talk about Charles Dickens, episode 4. Yeah. Well, you mentioned your blog earlier. You mentioned you'd written a blog post about... you'd done one on Superman, but then you also mentioned that you'd done a blog post on something else.
No, there's a Superman one, and then when Batman versus Superman came out, then I did another kind of follow-up, which also talked more about Zack Snyder and his philosophy, and touched on Steve Ditko and objectivism as well.
Right.
So for more of an exploration of that, then yeah, go to my blog and see my Batman versus Superman post.
Right, so that's rosslawhead.com?
rosslawhead.com/blog.
Right, cool. And I guess we should mention that there's been a bit of a change this week. We on the sort of technical side of things.
Yeah.
We now have our own website, which is fiction-hack.com.
Fiction-hack.com. Just rolls off the tongue.
Yeah.
So, yeah, go there and we'll have the episodes up when they come up. They'll appear there first, and I'll also be typing up show notes for all the episodes as well.
Uh-huh. The actual podcast is going to be there instead of on SoundCloud. So that's going to work out better for us too.
Yeah.
But still, if you want to get in touch, the best way to do it is with a hashtag #fictionhack on Twitter. We'll be monitoring that, and if anyone is listening and makes a comment, we will probably refer to it in some way. So get in touch with the hashtag #fictionhack. What's your Twitter handle?
@RossLawhead.
And I am @Colin_Munro. That is spelled Munro.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see you next time.
See you next time. Anyway, it's quite catchy.
I think I just found the Easter egg as well.
What Easter egg?